Hey, you've caught us kind of just in the middle of recording. We've already started recording some of the show. This is Paul Goody with my friend Ben Lawrence here.
Paul Goody.
And we're once again, as always, recording an hour-long conversation. It's not often that we describe what the show is at the top of the show, but here we are. And pretty exciting. Just so that you know, we're recording shows back-to-back because we're going to be taking off.
This is the number of this episode is 360. We've done 360 of these things.
That's right. It's come full circle, ladies and gentlemen. And those of you who listen to the end of our shows will eventually know what that means. So that's all I'm saying. Just listen to the end.
Oh, I hate that sort of clickbait. Watch to the end.
Yeah,
but in this case, seriously. I mean, I don't care. You can go ahead and like skip to the end of this if you want.
Yeah, I still feel like if we record two shows back to back on one audio file, it may stop the Dropbox from. We'll see. I could be. Here's the thing. I did take away some stuff, you know, because I was in. Ben, you know this. I was in a show called Glitch in the Matrix. It was a documentary. Yeah. I mean, the video that you see when you watch it on Hulu, some of that video was shot by me on my cameras and was sitting in the Dropbox. And as you know, Dropbox uses all of your space together, however many Dropboxes you have, the free Dropbox space. So that might be why I thought that I would run out if I did... you know, back-to-back recordings on one thing.
Dropbox is actually quite frustrating. But if even the paid service, I pay for Dropbox Pro. I have 2 terabytes of storage on my Dropbox, and it's still. I mean, I don't run out of storage, but I don't. Sometimes Dropbox's processes are dangerous. Like if you share. Same goes for Google Drive. If you share a Dropbox with somebody, and if they have Dropbox installed, like the Dropbox app installed on their computer, they start running out of space. I've run into the thought. Somebody runs out of space on their computer. They go to their shared Dropbox. It's like, oh, I don't need this anymore. And they delete it. But that deletes that thing for everybody else.
Oh, wow.
I've gone to Dropbox before, and I'm like, where are all these files that were stored here? All of my files, talking to people. Oh yeah, I deleted those off of my computer because I was running out of space. Well, you deleted them for me too.
That's crazy.
That's dangerous.
Luckily, unluckily, I don't know. Don't have too much that I do these days with that. So we'll see.
But if you try uploading it to Dropbox and it's not going to work, there's a service out there called WeTransfer.com, which allows you to transfer up to 2 gigs for free. You just use that.
Or, you know, I could cut it and upload half of it to you. But hopefully what happened? hopefully we won't need to. Yeah.
We won't need
to. Oh, man. Friend of the show, Zach Lewis. Did we ever have an episode where we talked to him?
He's never been on, no.
We were talking about doing it. Okay. There was one thing I did to him. I said, I've got a bad case of dog jaw. He said, dog jaw, and I pointed, and then he went in to look where I was pointing, and I turned my head to him and went, and he has claimed that I damaged his hearing. At that point, which I can believe.
You might have.
This is not a confession, however. In fact, that story might be fictional.
I seem to remember Jim Carrey doing that in a movie.
Oh, maybe that's what I was thinking of. Rather than an event that occurred.
An event that happened to you.
Yeah, exactly. So, for those of you who are interested, today is January. 19th, 2023. That's when we're recording this.
Yes.
And I have, once again, not really paid attention to anything going on in the news. I do have one story that I know about because Jennifer, my wife, told me about it.
Okay. Is this Ben gonna guess the news?
Yeah, Ben, go ahead and guess what...
What's the story I'm thinking of?
What? No, well, now use all your knowledge of me and my life and Jennifer. What type of story might Jennifer be most interested in that was in the news recently?
What type of story might she would be most interested
in? Yeah, what can you remember... like parties and stuff like that. What is Jennifer, what newsworthy events does my wife Jennifer Pratt focus on a lot?
Sort of putting me under the gun here.
Yeah.
You're assuming that I remembered what we all talked about at parties 20 years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
Would it have something to do with politics?
No.
Would it have something to do with technology?
No. I'm thinking of one thing in particular. And when I give you this hint, I think you may guess it. And if you don't, you know, we can continue to talk it through. But Jennifer had sort of a party trick that she would do that went through a transition when the news changed. And this was around the time when there was a news story, not political, right? A non-political news story that had a lot of people speculating about things. And it took place in the nation's capital.
A news story that took place in the nation's capital that had people speculating,
right,
about a lot of things. This was a recent history. We're not talking about, you know,
right, right. During 1800s. Contemporary in the news, contemporary to when we were when you lived in Mr. House. This is one of the places where I heard, and like I said, I would say that this is a party trick, kind of. It was a thing that sometimes she would go into about.
Does this have anything to do with the hijacked plane crashing into the Pentagon?
No, but you're extremely close with sort of the way that, or the kind of news that it would be related to. Sort of. Not, but again, I would say that's even a little bit too political, but not much.
Yeah.
Not much. So we're talking about terrorism of a sort,
but that yet has nothing to do with it. Oh, are these the snipers?
The DC snipers, Ben.
Lee Malvo was one of the names.
Jennifer used to, when we were at parties, would regale the people at the party with her theories regarding who the snipers were.
Okay.
And then, when the snipers were arrested, would still tell the same story, but now, it was these are the people that I, because she was like they're at ground level. They're not in buildings. They're at ground level. There's an older person and a younger person. If she were here, she could tell more about it. But she basically profiled the DC snipers. at parties. And then after they got caught, she was like, these are my profile. This is my profile, the DC snipers. And she was correct.
Yeah, Lee Boyd Malvo, who was 17, and John Allen Muhammad was 41 at the time.
Yeah.
And I'm closing that page. Because we keep it wrong here, and I want to say, and you probably know this because Jennifer probably knows this, that the killings appeared randomly. There appeared to be random killings. And I seem to want to say that there was one specific person that they wanted to kill, but then killed a bunch of other random people to throw off the scent of this one person, which might have been connected to the shooters.
Now, I know that that was something that was in a TV show. Probably an SVU or whatever based on
Jim Carrey TV show.
Yeah, exactly. It was Jim Carrey as. But you know, if you think about it, Ben, in some ways, every mass shooting is just sort of a remix, if you will, of other mass shootings.
Yep.
Nothing new under the sun, really.
We live in a remixed world.
Exactly.
So you bring this up because did something new happen in the news regarding the DC snipers, or
So that was sort of her thing.
That was her party
trick.
Yeah.
True crime and you know, speculation about it, things like that. So what sort of violent tragedy happened within the last couple of days that you may or may not have heard about? And if you haven't heard about it, tell me what it is. I don't know how that works.
Assuming this is connected. Is this the 6-year-old shooting their teacher?
No. Oh, my gosh. No.
Okay, it's not that. Is it a mass shooting of sorts?
It wasn't a shooting.
It was not a shooting.
No. So I'll tell you what it was, and maybe you've heard about it, maybe you haven't. But some people were stabbed in a house.
Oh, is this the University of Idaho?
That sounds right.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, I do know about this. My cousin's kid actually goes to that school. And so four people were stabbed while they were sleeping, and they did finally catch the guy who did it, like in Pennsylvania.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Yeah.
So one of the things that she mentioned, and this again goes right to the whole thing, that she said that some people were suspicious because there was a survivor who didn't call the police until, like, you know, 6 hours later or something like that. And they were saying it was suspicious. And she said, I wouldn't draw anything out of that. If you survived a whole bunch of people in your house being stabbed, you might not want to go anywhere or say anything for some time.
Right.
And she mentioned, you know, if they had come on scene and found her hiding under a bed, having not moved and having peed her pants or whatever, that would be understandable. But apparently, again, this is even worse than hearsay because I don't remember exactly the details that she said. But basically, she did call it in. The survivor did call it in. It's just that it was way later. And Jennifer's point was that even calling it in was kind of, you know, brave, even though it was
to the survivor's point of view, the murderer could either still be in the house or come back.
Yep, exactly. That's right.
Yeah. No, they catch the guy. He was a grad student.
When did they catch him?
There.
Does it say?
They caught him like about a week, 2 weeks ago.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was a grad student there in criminology.
Okay, well.
Yeah.
Not great.
This might not surprise you. A white dude.
It is funny how many people who get into law enforcement are themselves capable of criminal activity.
Well, I mean, if you want to believe that that's how law enforcement recruits new recruits. You look for the violent kid. You look for the kid who's got a beef with society. I know. Wow. I saw this story. I can't remember where I saw it, but it was an explanation of why law enforcement officials tend to steer right politically, because a number of there was a push by the right to recruit right-leaning kids to be police officers.
I mean, yeah.
And, like, you know, the troubled kids who can't get along in society, who just feel like society has left them behind in some way, and so now they have a grudge against it.
What are we talking about?
How true is that? I don't know.
How hard it is to get someone to hurt other people. Like, we think that it's easy, but it actually can be difficult.
Yeah.
I don't know. The statistics about people who fire over people's heads in war and stuff like that, who don't actually aim for them.
In Japan, which apparently, if they've stopped it by now, I don't know, but when they used to at least do capital punishment, they had four buttons in a room. Only one of the buttons operated the trap door of the noose.
Right.
And you had four people pushing the button at the same time, so nobody knew who actually was the one that caused the death of the person who was
beat to death. Right, it's like the firing squad with the blanks.
Yeah.
And stuff like that. Everyone can have a plausible deniability, which makes me feel
helps you sleep better at night, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like here's the thing. I have jumped off of a bridge that was 600 feet above a ravine. And there's a part of you that you have to fight past in order to do that. And it really is difficult. It really is hard to do.
There's this video that came across my feed just yesterday, actually, that was more footage of people jumping off of the World Trade Center as it was on fire.
Yeah.
And you can actually see people like clinging on to the outside of the building and then just letting go. And I put myself in that position. Like, would I be brave enough to do that? But if the calculation is, do I want to burn to death, choke to death, or jump? You know, what would be the least painful? What would be instantaneous? But I just can't imagine, like, I'm sure my fingers would not let go even if I had made that horrible choice.
Yeah, it is really interesting. And so that's the only thing, like, sense memory wise, whatever, that's the only thing that I can draw upon as far as killing someone. Probably the same thing. You probably have to fight through, you know, a mental block of I don't really want to hurt this person.
Yeah, unless you're a certain type of person who just doesn't have that. And those people are out there.
And so, yeah, I don't know. It's you've most likely had the same sort of dreams that I have every once in a while, where in the dream you have already killed someone. Or even, yeah. I mean, and I hate to, you know, bring the room down, but those dreams where you are trying to kill someone and it's taking way too long, and you're trying different things and none of it seems to be working.
And you get frustrated.
Yeah, I was about to say, and you're just frustrated.
Oh yeah, I've
always
had
interesting. And then you wake up. That.
Yeah, and you're like, oh, thank God.
Yeah, those dreams are good. The ones that are horrible to wake up from, and I'm sure that you've had this too, dreams where you're in a relationship with someone and you're like, oh, I love this person, and then you wake up, oh, that person doesn't exist, not there at all. There was a really interesting thing where I had a dream, where I met Jennifer.
Oh, really?
But we were younger, and I was meeting her for the first time in a totally different situation. She was working as a waitress somewhere, or not a waitress, a hostess. So like a restaurant type thing. She was at the little desk thing in the front of things, and I knew that it was her, and I knew that I was me, but that this was a different situation. And when I woke up, and I had that feeling of, oh, I just met this exciting person. And then I was like, oh, and we're married. it was nice. It was the same sort of dream where normally you would be sad, but instead I was just happy. And I'm sure that she was confused as to why I was so like goofy and overly affectionate that day.
Paul Goody keeping that spark alive for 15 years.
Yeah.
Or however long it's been.
I feel as though I could do more and I should do more. And it's one of those things that, you know, I feel that is a thing about a marriage. If you're thinking to yourself, yep, doing everything right, this is all just going to stay the same way it always is. If you think that, that's a problem.
I'm watching The White Lotus on HBO right now, and it's kind of like the same sort of themes where there are, in at least in this, I'm just on the first season, there are two couples, one couple that's been married for who knows how long, but they have like teenage children, and one and a newlywed couple that's on their honeymoon, and you can
Ben, I'm sorry. Teenage children, they have teenage children. Okay, go ahead.
But for those, like, for those people who are either married or have been in, like, really long-term relationships, you can see, like, in the old married couple, oh, if I, you know, if that's what it's going to end up like, a pretty much a, like a loveless marriage of sorts. Where you're roommates at that point, or you also don't want to follow the newlywed couple because you're looking at how the guy's behaving. You're like, oh, that's what's not to do as a newlywed married person.
Yeah, for sure. I'm looking at Edward's gums. He got teeth extracted, as you know. He's looking all right. So the White Lotus, haven't seen it. We've both seen Glass Onion now.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I saw The Pale Blue Eye on Netflix. Pretty good. Recommend it. I watched all of Willow.
I haven't seen it.
The Disney Plus Willow. And I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. It really hit the fantasy tropes in a good way.
I'll say one last thing about The White Lotus. It's HBO, along with the TV show Succession, is really leaning into the horrible rich white people genre.
Mm. Yeah, people love to...
Surprising how popular these shows are about that specific thing.
Apparently, anyway, love to watch shows that are about people that no one should like. Game of Thrones, same thing.
Have you seen The Last of Us?
Yes. Have you played The Last of Us?
I have not played The Last of Us.
Okay. So
I've seen playthroughs, not playthroughs, but I've seen gameplay footage.
So you might already know this, this is a Ben's going to guess the news a little bit anyway. Hey. What was the accomplishment that some people really liked and other people really didn't like that The Last of Us TV show did in their first episode?
The backstory?
No.
Oh.
There's something that there's a technical achievement that they did that may be a first. In fact, I don't know if there's any other property that has done this.
A technical achievement, not like a storytelling achievement, but a technical achievement.
A technical achievement. And I guess you could say it's storytelling achievement, but I really think it would be a technical achievement.
I don't remember seeing any sort of like visual effects that blew me away.
Okay,
I did like the opening. I did like the opening title sequence though.
I'll give you some examples of what I'm talking about. So like, are you familiar with Rope by Alfred Hitchcock?
I have not seen it.
Okay.
Is it a one-shot? Was there a one-shot in The Last of Us?
Okay, so we're getting there, right? So a one-shot, right?
Yeah.
There have been one-shots before, so that's not really an achievement, right? But there have been one-shots before. Name for instance, another HBO show that had a one-shot that was really famous.
True Detective.
That's right. Okay, so we understand, right? True Detective did that one-shot. Yeah. What was interesting about the Gus Van Sant Psycho? What did people say about it?
I haven't seen that either, but it was a shot-for-shot remake, right?
Right. Okay, so taking those two things into consideration, The Last of Us TV show did something technically... they did a technical thing that probably hasn't been done before. What do you think maybe it was?
Perhaps a shot-by-shot remake of gameplay footage.
Yes! Okay, so from the time that we have Joel's brother show up in the truck.
Yeah. Or spoilers for episode one of The Last of Us.
So when Joel and his brother show up in the truck, to the point
after, like,
where
everything hits the fan, you know, the daughter wakes up and like he's gone to pick his brother up from prison.
Yep.
Or from jail.
To the point where again, spoilers. To the point where she gets shot.
Okay.
Right?
You know, it's funny because during that sequence, like, you see, you're like the point of view of the you're inside the truck as it's driving through the field, and I'm like, this looks like it could be from the video game.
it was exactly from the video game. Now that, and so, and when I say that some people didn't like it and some people did, I'm not speaking about like reviewers or things like that. I'm saying this is what I saw.
Yeah.
Right? I witnessed a conversation where somebody was like, if I wanted to see that, I would just have watched the video game.
Right, right.
On a comment on a video that someone else made saying, I just want you to know, people who made this TV show, that the fans saw this and we thank you for caring about, you know, what we what we did. So,
well, I mean,
so some people really liked seeing it. Other people,
I mean, as
thought,
we mentioned, as we mentioned last week, the creator of the game is the showrunner, or a co-creator of the TV show. Maybe not necessarily the showrunner of The Last of Us, but he's deeply involved.
Yeah, no, he is. Yeah, the two showrunners are the guy who did Chernobyl and
Craig Mazin.
And then the guy who did The Last of Us video game. So
yeah.
Oh, And how about that ending? Never did I think hearing an 80s song playing on a radio would have such a... I mean, that was dramatic as hell for me. It was great. Choice of the music and, you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it's really good storytelling because you knew immediately what it meant.
Yep, exactly. And I feel like the two leads that they have for the show are doing great.
And I do know that the casting of Bella Ramsey was frowned upon in the fan community because she doesn't look like the video game character.
So, and yeah, the thing I would say about that is that I believe that just like Scott McCloud's understanding comics, right? The 3D character versus a real person, you're not going to get someone who looks exactly like that person. And I think that they went with acting ability. You know, HBO knows her because she's been in their properties before, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think that she's going to do fine. I think she's going to be good.
Yeah. No, and I don't think any... I think HBO made the right call in casting somebody who's got the chops as opposed to just some rando who looks like a video game character.
Exactly. And I feel like... I will say this. The character of Ellie in The Last of Us runs into a problem that, and I'm choosing my words carefully here because I don't want to disparage anyone too much, but she's not, she has run into problems with some members of the, and I'm putting fan in quotes here, fan community, because for one reason or another, she wasn't dateable. They, because of their choice of her sexuality, the fact that she's a child at the beginning, all these things are things that certain segments of the community were mad about.
Well, as we've learned over the course of the last however many god-awful years, that toxic fans can be toxic, and it's best not to even listen to them.
I was talking to Jennifer about this today. I was talking about how... you know, you have stories, right? And the story itself is sort of a base. There's a core to stories, and stories normally have some sort of moral to them. Aesop's fables, for example, very much so, very very much. They even, you know, have the moral at the end for you. But in the same way, an example I used with her when we were talking, Star Trek, right? The moral, if you will, of Star Trek, the thing that it's trying to show is, you know, you've got people from all different nations coming together on this one starship to explore, and they're all working together, and it's a post-scarcity society. Replicators can give you anything you want.
Yeah.
Exactly. And people who claim to be fans of Star Trek were mad about Star Trek Discovery being too woke. And it's like, what show are you... I don't want to call anyone out, but I know people who's made that statement, and how they're excited about Strange... They were excited about Strange New Worlds because it was getting back to Star Trek being Star Trek. You know, that sort of thing. Which I haven't seen, by the way.
Which, you know, Star Trek being Star Trek being the first TV show to show an interracial kiss on TV. In the 60s, if nobody knows.
Speaking of interracial kiss, Gene Simmons... should have been more diverse when putting his band together.
Hey, they're all black and white.
Ben, wait. Hold on. So you take the thing with Frank Gorshin as the black and white alien and the arguments with that, but you splice in, whenever they're talking about that, splice in footage of Gene Simmons and the other members of... It could work. This is a... But probably not.
There was... I heard this story, speaking of, like, this anti-woke culture that we find ourselves in.
Jeez.
I read a story where there was a read-along. I don't know if it was in person or if it was on Zoom, but they were reading Dr. Seuss's The Star-Bellied Sneetches. And at some point, somebody put an end to it and stopped the entire thing once they realized that it was about racism.
Really?
Yeah.
When there's a read-through, are you talking about celebrities or
No, I'm talking about like a library, like a librarian was having story time with a bunch of kids, and a parent, I'm not saying this is what happened, I'm saying this is like the gist of what happened.
Yeah.
And a parent stopped it, or an administrator, because I don't see a parent like being able to stop this kind of thing, or the administrator of the library... who, like, maybe subscribes to, like, Ron DeSantis' anti-CRT curriculum, stopped the reading because he realized this story was about racism and overcoming it.
You know, and the interesting thing is, of course, the machine, right, is that gives and takes away the stars is prescient, right? We don't have that machine when it comes to things like racism. For culture stuff, sometimes we kind of do. But it's interesting to me that we are still behind, if that makes sense. Like we're in a time now where we know that we aren't far enough along. I think about this all the time when I talk about, you know, when I was in college, I've talked about this before, but I went to the University of Missouri Columbia, and at the time that I was there, there was a theater program and there was a black theater program. And the reason there had to be a black theater program is because black students were not cast in the main stage shows at that time. In order for them to get the the stage time that they needed, they put together this other program. And at the time, like, I had been told in schools and things like that that we were past racism, right?
Yeah, and yet your theater department was segregated.
Right, exactly. And I had conversations with... you know, adults about affirmative action at the time. And these adults said that they weren't racist. They just felt as though affirmative action was wrong because the most qualified person should be the one that gets the job.
Right.
To which I said, that's interesting because you then have the assumption that the most qualified person isn't going to be a person of color. And they're like, well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying, well, if the most qualified person would be, then you could have both your meritocracy and your affirmative action. You could, both those things would be, the box would be checked by the applicant. And one of the interesting things, of course, that I run into now, because I have, you know, then this is, this is me talking about work without talking about work. I have been on hiring committees, right?
Yeah.
And I know, just based on that, that when you get into the top candidates for things, there are very many different pros and cons to every single candidate. And you talk about it a lot. Well, if we go with this person, there's this, this, and this. If we go with this person, it's this, this, and this. So the idea that, oh, this person was just obviously more qualified than you is a hard pill to swallow.
When
you get down to the top candidates.
Yeah. I do some work for a local nonprofit that supports a large public institution, and they were actually talking about that. They were talking about a recent round of hiring that they did. And the executive director looked at the candidates and after like the first round of interviews. And he looked at the candidates who were selected to go to the next round of interviews and noticed that they were all white. And so he said, we have to stop and we have to look at the marginalized, the historically marginalized races that have also applied for this job and rethink our positions or rethink our decisions about who goes on to the next level. And so they did pick a couple other, I don't know if they removed some of the previous candidates that made it to the second round or if they just added like two more.
Yeah.
But they ended up actually, after having a second round with one of the persons of color, one of the non-white, I guess that's what I should say, one of the non-white applicants, they ended up hiring her. And they were like gloating about how great she was. And the thing is, yeah, she would not have made it to the second round if they had not been looking at it through that lens.
Exactly. And so that's the part that I guess, you know, and I will say that the candidate pool that we had was more diverse than that. Right. Yeah. And so the thing that, and I think our stories end up in the same place, which is that those guidelines, right, are doing what they're supposed to be doing, which is cutting through learned cultural bias.
Yeah.
And whoever put those things in place made the right call. And again, the one thing I think about Generation Z, right, is that they will have reasons to be mad at Gen X because we've kind of raised them to fight where we didn't, if that makes sense. Where we were like, things are just bad.
Yeah, we were the whatever generation, and so...
Yeah.
You know, it's it was our job to clean up the mess the boomers made, and we didn't.
Oh, and I would even say that we needed to be the whatever generation so that we would say whatever to what the boomers are doing and then say whatever to what Gen Z starts driving. The purpose of Generation X should be in our old age to enable them to say, okay, yeah, all right. Because here's the thing, right? We're of the opinion, well, this can't get any worse, right? We think that, nothing matters. Or this will never be anything but worse, I guess, is a way to think about it. If we just continue with that attitude, then why not let the people who have a better idea have all the money and do all the things? What do we need it for? You know, I don't know how that's going to work out, but I mean, because if you're a boomer listening to the show, hey, boomer, no problems. Obviously, but the boomers are starting to die out. And
that is one of the few things actually that kind of gives me hope, is that the older generation is dying out. Now, granted, I say that with elderly parents, so I definitely do not want to die. But along with that, the trend of people moving further religiously and further to the right as they get older is slowing down.
Yeah. I will say that my parents... So I've got... It's a weird situation. I feel like... So let's see. When is the... Could you see when does Generation X start?
It's in the mid-60s sometime. Let me look it up.
Because, all right, so my biological father, my adopted father, is a member of the Silent Generation, which is crazy.
65. It's mid-60s somewhere, but like generally 65 to 80.
Okay, so 73 minus 16 is
57.
Yeah. So I guess my biological dad is a boomer. But we're right on the cusp.
Oh,
right. Yeah. Because he was young when I was born.
That's right.
So
he was 16.
So yeah. 16. And yeah, it's an interesting story for the ages, as it were. He was in Chicago around the time that, you know, you've got gangs like the Warriors in the film The Warriors. And he was involved in an altercation when my mother was pregnant with me. They shipped him out of the city for a little bit so that he could like kind of go straight.
They meaning like the cops?
His parents, I believe.
Okay.
Send him to live on a farm. And then
in upstate New York.
Oh my god. And then he came back and learned that he was going to be a dad. They were both young, so I was, yeah, you know, put up to for adoption. And then, you know, had a life and was eventually contacted by me.
Mm-hmm.
Was willing to meet. And when we talk, whenever we do stuff, we are very similar generationally. You know, yeah, there is not that much of that 16 years is not a lot.
I have friends who have siblings who are 16 years apart.
Yep.
Or more.
So we have a lot of cultural milestones that we, yep, both experienced, which is a little crazy.
Which is interesting, too, because when I was growing up, my sister was 4 years older than me, and that felt like a generation.
Yeah.
An entire different generation when I was a kid.
My brother Dan, 4 years older than me. So,
yeah.
Yeah, it's all a little crazy.
Especially when you're that young. And, like, when I was 12, she was 16 and got her driver's license. And I'm like, my sister is an adult now, you know, and I'm still just a kid.
Yeah, exactly. And as you get older, you know, now, right, I view, like I view Chris Compte as a peer, right? He's older than me. He would have been an adult when I was a kid, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, as you get older, that stuff stops mattering. Once you reach a certain thing where you're just old, and you and the other fellow olds that you have, you know that there's a difference between you, but the younger kids don't.
Well, but yeah, then I do, when I talk to, say, members of, or like millennials who are now starting to get into their 40s, and Gen Z kids, I do feel very, very old. I brought this up the other day to somebody. I was watching The Menu, that which has Nicholas Hoult in it. Nicholas Hoult.
You know, I saw The Menu also.
Yeah. Great movie. But Nicholas Hoult, as you know, plays the war boy Nux in one of my favorite, yep, films, Mad Max Fury Road. Nicholas
what
Hoult
a great
was
film.
Nicholas Hoult was the boy in the Hugh Grant movie about a boy.
Wow, that's crazy.
Which is when I realized that, I'm like, that, because that doesn't feel like it was a old Nicholas Hoult being a young Nicholas Hoult distance away in time.
Here's something. Dudley Dursley, right, in the Harry Potter films. The kid who played that kid, played Edgar Allan Poe in the Netflix show The Pale Blue Eye, which I highly recommend. He did a great job, but he's unrecognizable at this point. He's an adult. He was in, what's the Coen Brothers Western, thing that Netflix did?
Buster Scruggs, the Ballad of Buster Scruggs.
Ballad of Buster Scruggs. He was in that as well.
The Bastard of Buller Scruggs.
There was one other thing that he was in that I can't remember, but yeah, doing great.
Have you ever seen the movie, or had you ever seen the movie from Spielberg, Empire of the Sun? It's got John Malkovich.
Yeah, John Malkovich and Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, Batman, was the little boy in that movie.
Also in The Pale Blue Eye, by the way.
Bringing it all back around.
Yeah, exactly. 360, Ben.
360. Maybe a theme.
The fun thing, and I'm spoilers really quick for The Pale Blue Eye. Sorry, everybody. But the neat thing about The Pale Blue Eye is that you watch it all the way through, and then at the very end, there's a twist. And that twist makes you, and you don't have to review it,
question
in my opinion,
life.
But it makes you see all the other events in a brand new way. Again, spoilers. Most people wouldn't necessarily consider that a spoiler, but if you say, here's the thing that's crazy about me. If you just say to me, you won't believe the ending. If you just say that, right? That's a spoiler to me. Because all of a sudden, I'll be watching it going, okay, so what's the ending going to be? What am I?
Right.
It takes me out of the film.
I'm actually quite the opposite. If you mention a spoiler to me, unless it's like right before I watch something, chances are I'm going to forget what you said.
Yeah. For me, as soon as I know the movie exists, that's it. Totally. Might as well not even watch it now. Thanks a lot.
Damn it!
Hey, did you know that Jordan Peele made a movie called Nope? Oh, great. Thanks a lot.
Which I finally saw, by the way.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I know you wanted to talk about it, but I hadn't seen it yet.
What was I going
to
talk about? Now I don't remember. Wait. Spoilers for Nope. Spoilers for Nope. I know exactly what it was. And that's that after seeing it for days afterwards. It's not as bad now, but for days afterwards, I couldn't look at the sky without being a little uneasy. It was really effective.
Yeah, I can see that. I do understand the, because when it was out, when everybody was watching it, there was a large part of like white audiences going, I don't get it, or it's slow, you know? And then people of color would counter that with, this movie's not for you.
What do they mean by I don't get it or it's slow?
I don't know. I never asked. No. I mean, yeah. I don't know. I don't know. Like,
the only
that was just one
of
the things that I would... One of the criticisms from white people that I read about that movie.
One of the things that I think maybe is happening, and this might be what they meant when they said it's not for you, is that it's a character study of these people, right? There's also this monster, but a lot of it has to do with the relationship, the familial relationship between the brother and the sister, right?
That's actually one of the things that like Jordan Peele set out because to write that movie because he wanted a brother-sister relationship, like a really tight brother-sister relationship on screen.
If you don't care about other people, then you're not going to enjoy those parts of the movie. I think a lot of it also, like, people talk about, a lot of the film, right, is just the brother looking at things, right? Yeah. He looks at things and he stares at something and again, if you don't if you don't appreciate that, you may not enjoy the film as much. I remember an acting teacher I had who said a thing, or directing. He was an acting teacher and a directing teacher. This was in a directing class. He, for the first 5 minutes of the class, he just sat there. And then
Maria
he said,
Abramovic style.
He exactly, yes. And he said, just observing a human being is fascinating. If that human being lets you in and allows you to see them as they really are, it's mesmerizing. And that's really what you're doing as a director, is you're putting the people in a situation where you will want to watch them. So for me, watching that actor, you know, because in my head, watching him observe what's happening and looking at things and all that was interesting.
Yeah. I think it's also, I think one of the reasons why white people like didn't get it or felt it was too slow is because white people don't have that sort of lived cultural experience where death, danger, harm can come from anywhere at any time.
Yeah. There's a guy I went to college with. I went to the University of Missouri, Columbia, and at the student newspaper and at the radio station. And there was a guy who was like around those areas. His name was Paris. And he talked about something that later on I saw like a stand-up comic do. But I believe that I heard it from him first. Where he was like, I don't know any black person who bungee jumps. Because bungee jumping was a famous thing. He's like, you don't need any artificial danger in your life.
Yeah.
I don't need to pay to feel like I could be hurt. And that stuck with me as well. Speaking about
even as you bungee jumped off a 600
foot ravine. I have an illusion of safety that I have experienced in my life. You know, it is funny. I think you've been in a situation like this too before in your life. I have been in multiple situations where I felt as though I could die. And I was in one situation, I think I mentioned this before, in camp, where I actually was held underwater until I passed out. And I came to. The only person there was during a game called Dunk City, where you hold people underwater.
That's horrible.
The kid held me underwater. And I woke up, and the only person there was a student counselor who said, "You can't tell anybody about this or we'll get in trouble." And so I didn't. And I've only really felt comfortable talking about it.
Because they recently. Were right.
Yeah. Oh, but the implication was I would also get in trouble. Which now I know is not
that
true.
That would not have been correct. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, it was it is still an experience that I remember. The screaming underwater, and then the feeling of intaking water after my scream, but then also just coming to, right, first, if that makes sense. Like, it everything's sort of out of order in my head a little bit.
Yeah.
Because and there's another period of time that I talk about in A Glitch in the Matrix where I kind of came to after a break, like a sort of a psychotic break.
Just in the church.
That's what I would term it as. Yeah, the church thing. And then there's another one where I was at a church social thing at my old religious school where I bit into a helium balloon and inhaled a whole bunch of helium all at once. Like just a huge chunk, and it all went in. and I came to then. Now, when I think about it, I put all those things in chronological order. But at the times when I came to, the only way I can describe it, it was like the first time that I had ever been alive.
You respawned.
Basically, yes. Respawn. And then all of a sudden, I would come back into consciousness. And then in
Your memory would load.
Yeah. In dream times, it's the exact opposite. When I become conscious in a dream, everything has been fine and progressing normally. And then all of a sudden, I wake up in the dream. And I realize that everything that I was remembering up to that point is kind of fabricated. So it's sort of the exact opposite. The all of a sudden coming into reality and the all of a sudden fakeness, realizing that everything around me is a facade, Ben. Yes.
Everything's fake. Nothing is real. It's all made up.
Look, what I'm saying is that you and I have already done a good job with the Goody Lawrence, but the goal of every human being is to become fictional, because a fictional human being outlasts and outlives a real human being.
Speaking of outlasting and outliving, we're coming to the end of this hour. Paul, do you want to... Because we sort of teased... What, at the beginning of this episode, what would be the twist at the end?
Oh, the twist at the end is, of course, that we are doing two episodes back-to-back because Ben is going to be away. Ben, where are you going?
I am going to New York City.
New York City. And so next week, there will actually be a... another episode related to this one, because we had to record these at the same time. So enjoy that, ladies and gentlemen. And Ben, that's all I have to say on the subject. We'll talk to you next week and keep it wrong.
Keep it wrong, Paul. I'll talk to you later. And we're clear.